As Morgan noted, we begin a series of sporadic services this summer focused on sin and the virtues, the holy seven virtues, among other special services that we have going on as well this summer. But I suspect, though, if you're like me, a series of sermons on sin doesn't exactly turn us on. In fact, what we know is that many people in our culture today have stopped going to church because the church is just too judgmental. In other words, maybe the church has focused too much on sin. We want to go to church to be inspired with a good and a noble vision. We want to sing songs about a gracious and merciful God, a God who welcomes us back with open arms and leads us into greener pastures of joy and hope and peace and kindness to others. So not only is our order of worship a little mixed up or disorienting for us this morning, so is the subject matter. As the great theologian Karl Barth said a century or so ago, we shouldn't give sin and the devil too much attention. Like the recent practice of not releasing the names of those mass killers, because we don't want to honor evil and those evil actions by calling attention to those tragically, horribly real circumstances. The Christian church believes that evil and sin was defeated on the cross and the resurrection of Jesus so that it no longer holds a power over us. And our focus instead should be on walking in the resurrection, this divine calling to do good. And yet, perhaps in our rush to embrace God's grace and forgiveness, maybe we do miss a rather important aspect of our theology. This central sort of undercurrent through the Bible is sin and rebellion that's present, this resistance to God's ways. And we certainly, if we don't focus, or at least we focus on the welcoming nature of God, we miss the cross of Jesus. Like, why was the cross of Jesus important? Why did it happen? And we misrepresent the ministry of Jesus if we think that Jesus only came to preach love and peace and understanding. Why was Jesus killed for doing something as noble and kind as that? If Jesus was just a nice friend to everyone, preach tolerance and grace and forgiveness and love, it certainly wouldn't land him on the cross. Most of us will remember that Jesus did have a few harsh words in his ministry. The harsh words, though, weren't to the outsiders, they were to the insiders, to pastor types and religious folks like us, calling us whitewashed tombs or something worse, like hypocrites. That's why we killed Jesus, because he showed us in his life and ministry and in a few words that, well, we've fallen short of God's best intentions. Our love is misplaced at times. Our love for God and neighbor doesn't always come out as, well, as good as we'd like it to. And so the issue for most of us when it comes to sin is not that we don't believe in it, because we see it every day in the headlines. As theologian Reinhold Niebuhr said, it's the most empirically verifiable aspect of the Christian doctrine is sin. We see it. It's out there. It's observable. We humans make mistakes. We know it. It's just that we want to talk about somebody else's sin. We want to talk about the big sin that's out there, the racism, the sexism, militarism, materialism. We want to talk about maybe the sins of our presidents, their arrogance, lack of morality. But the reality is, when we come to the seven deadly sins, it's not the sin that's out there that they deal with. It's not the big isms of our culture and world. It's pride, it's envy, it's sloth, greed, lust, wrath, gluttony. Those things that point back at us that we find so difficult to look at. For Christians, we learn about sin primarily as we look at the life of Jesus. And we see God's grace and mercy in Jesus, then we're able to admit our sinfulness and be honest and open with our sin. As William Willimon, who writes a book by its title, says, we learn to be a sinner by coming to church. Our lifelong learning of how to be a sinner, or sinning like a Christian, is the title of his book. Because for the most part, we think we're good people. We're good until we see Jesus, until we meet Jesus and see the hard truth of our lives. We'll take pride, for instance. That's the one we focus a bit on here this morning. Pride can seem like a pretty good thing. Having a healthy sense of self-esteem is a good thing, a healthy thing. We should take pride in our work. Parents tell children to take pride in your job. Employees of a business, corporate pride is a good thing. Take pride in your work. Jesus says, love your neighbor as yourself. You should love yourself a little bit to love your neighbor the same way. The atheist philosopher Bertrand Russell talks about peacocks. They're proud, right? Peacocks, they don't really envy another peacock's tail because they think their own tail is the best in the world. And consequently, peacocks are peaceable birds because they have a sense of pride in their own tail. Well, if there is a subtle or healthy pride in all of us, there is probably not so subtle lines that we cross with our pride when we come across as being the smartest person in the room, or we fail to listen to those around us, we're taking counsel from others, where we take too much credit for ourselves and our own achievements. Pride comes out with the story of Adam and Eve and their temptation and failure in the garden. When they trust their own judgment over the voice and instructions of God, there's pride in that story. There's pride in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. As they live so close together in their earthly life, right outside the gate is this poor man, Lazarus, and yet the rich man doesn't really see or take interest in the poor man. Pride is living as if others in our world don't exist. We don't see some people because pride glosses over and taints our outlook. Pride is subtle, sneaks into almost every area of our lives. And we can tell some stories, all of us, I'm sure, of where pride got the better of us, or how in the Proverbs it says and reminds us that pride goeth before a fall. Obvious, sometimes unfortunate accounts I can tell of being young or maybe not so young. When I was too focused on myself, waving out the window, driving along in the truck, too proud of what I was doing to see where I was going, and I ended off the road, and yet back on the road, fortunately, or waving out the window another time and my mirror clipped a telephone pole, or even more tragically, in the presence of Dawn's extended family on a Sunday afternoon, driving a motorcycle way too fast across the backyard with a young nephew behind me, ending up sliding, tumbling, crashing in the grass as the family looked on in horror. Because the joy and arrogance, I was blinded to the wash line that was coming up way too fast. Blinded by our arrogance. Pride comes out in so many different ways in our lives, in our common life together, in our relationships here at church, when we're sitting and working in committees, when we fail to listen to those around us or respect or notice others in conversation with us or maybe beyond us. The serpent to Adam and Eve offers the opportunity to be like God in the garden, and that's sort of the initial grasp of pride, is to be like God. As someone has said, it's the first of the deadly sins because it relates to all the others. It's something we feel inside before it comes out in an action. It's hard to avoid. And so it can come to many of us in many good ways, in many good things. Sometimes it's even called Mennonite pride, when we stand back and we admire our accomplishments or our achievements, whether great or small, in our service to others, in our peacemaking, in our disaster work, in our mission work. We take a little too much pride in ourselves and we fail to truly love God and our neighbor. It's misdirected. It comes back at us. And so I conclude this first part of my sermon with the question, when was the last time you were aware of your pride?